Because anyway, I'm a civilian, total civilian. I have had two meals with serving officers. One was 40 years ago, when I went to the officers' mess at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital at Woolwich, as was, having given a talk there on, curious enough, Legionnaires' disease, which of course was first discovered amongst a group of ex-army people in the States. And this, about a sort of few months before that, my wife and I were having lunch on the military train between Marienborn and West Berlin, along the corridor there. Yeah, okay, you were there. And we were staying in Germany with a family. He was in the Royal Engineers, and that's how we managed to get into across Checkpoint Charlie into East Berlin, which was quite a bizarre experience when you see a signpost to Warsaw, 150 kilometres, and that sort of thing. Anyway, Navy. Well, I went on HMS Belfast once, and my total Air Force experience is constructing a Lancaster bomber from an Air Force kit, an Air Force kit. So I should feel completely out of place here. I mean, for example, you talk about operations theatres. I don't think you understand them in the same way that I as a doctor do. So we do talk a funny language. But actually, I don't feel out of place at all. Because not only have I had an opportunity to actually meet quite a number of you, which I've really enjoyed and had a lovely meal with you, but the fact of the matter is, we do all share the same commanding officer, Commander-in-Chief. And I'd like to just share some of the experiences I've had over the years with him in the various postings in such exotic places as London and Nottingham and Oxford. Even us civvies know about Nelson. This is called Trafalgar Square. And here on the north corner of Trafalgar Square is the National Gallery, in which there was this wonderful work of art, which the nation bought 50 years ago for about the equivalent nowadays of £15 million. That's a lot of money, £15 million. It's not even a painting. It's not even an oil painting. It's actually technically a cartoon, which means it's done with charcoal, white chalk, on 8 layers of stained paper. That's what it is. He never did produce the oil painting that he was going to. Why did it cost so much? Well, it wasn't just because it was by Leonardo. It's one of the most popular items in the National Gallery even now. Why is that? Why so much money? It's because it is staggeringly beautiful. It's absolutely lovely. At least that was the case until the 17th of July 1987, when the army stepped in. And that actually is literally true, because 10 minutes before closing, a guy called Robert Cambridge, who'd been discharged from the army, was unemployed and had some mental health issues. I think that's not totally unaware, is it? Anyway, what he does, he walked up to this painting, and he was wearing his army greatcoat. So he goes up to this painting, or this work, this cartoon, stands 2 metres away from it, opens his coat, pulls out a shotgun, 12 ball, and fires. Deer hunters called a heart shot. Interesting psychology behind that. That was a total disaster. They had to take it down, and then they had to work out if there's anything they could do about it. Now, it had been protected by laminated glass, otherwise the damage would have been even worse. But eventually they discovered it had fragmented into, just that middle bit which you'd put your fist through, had fragmented into 270 pieces, most of which were smaller than a pinhead, and some of which were now scattered around the floor of the gallery. They got all these people together, and the problem was nobody anywhere in the world had ever repaired a cartoon on paper like this. So they called in a guy called Eric Harding from the British Museum to ask him if he could do anything with it. And he eventually wrote a technical bulletin, National Gallery number 13, which is absolutely fascinating reading, about how he tackled it. First of all, he had to work out where every single one of those 270 pieces, each of which was put in a separate label box, belonged in the original painting. Every single one. Then the problem was how to put them back and fix them. And because it had never been done before, he didn't dare experiment on this. So he tried to work out all sorts of different ways of recreating the same damage on a similar canvas with laminated glass over it, and nothing worked. So he actually called in the Metropolitan Firearms Unit, expert with a similar shotgun, to cause a similar damage. And from that, he played around with that, experimented with that, invented new techniques, and 22 months later, which is what you see now. Actually, I think I might even turn the backlight off. Yeah, thank you. It's the middle switch. It is glorious, isn't it? It wasn't actually the first time the National Gallery had been targeted in this way, because 100 years ago this year, one of the famous works of art there by Velázquez is colloquially known as the Rokesby Venus. I'm not going to show it to you because it's slightly erotic and it's before the 9 o'clock watershed anyway. What happened was that was hacked several times by a meat cleaver wielded by a lady called Mary Richardson, who was one of the suffragettes. So that's two works of art severely damaged, but both fully restored to their original beauty. And this can actually happen to works of art accidentally, like this one here. Antonella da Messina is a Sicilian, and this is part of a portrait that's up in the Mandrilleschi Museum there. And unfortunately, it's got dropped. And of all the places to get the gouges, you get it right over the middle of the face. Bad news. But again, a lot of time was taken over this. There we are. And this is the actual, what you'll see now. And some people call that the male Mona Lisa, as you can see why, can't you? Lovely, isn't it? Who wants to look at that? And a second thing that can happen to paintings, not just damage, is just wear and tear, you know, sort of life and fading and so on. And this is Francesco Cosa, and it's in the Pantheon in Rome, and it's a fresco, part of a fresco. I'll show you the whole thing in a minute. That is pretty sorry state, isn't it? I mean, who'd want to go and look at that? Well, I have no idea how they managed to do that to it, but they did. And here is the full thing. He did two frescoes. Adoration of the Magi was another one, I think. Okay. So this is a long time ago. And if you go a couple of kilometres down the road to the Sistine Chapel, you come to Michelangelo, of course, with that fabulous stuff he's done there. And in the 1980s, they decided it needed a really major restoration, because they were looking like this, you see. Faded. I mean you can hardly see that. Yeah, and this is partway through the restoring, and what they've been doing is they've been cleaning it up, starting from the edge of working, leaving the face to the end. Now, I wonder what the face is going to look like. Well, I'll show you what it did look like, a bit closer up. You can see there's one or two marks there and there, and there's another spot somewhere else, all of which had to be sorted out. But when you look at this bit here, the early bit, you'd think, I think I can begin to guess what might come out at the end, which was that. Ah, now that's all right, isn't it? That's got to be good. Okay, so that's another way paintings can be affected. This is an interesting one. It's this is, of course, Pete Paul Rubens. And this is in the Institute of Art in Chicago, but I don't know how many people who go there actually realise that it's got a deep secret. And it literally is a deep secret, because if you take that bit there and you put it in an X-ray machine, underneath that there, you have a completely different picture of a nobleman, okay, who's actually sort of a layman. And this picture has been overpainted, it's a technical word for overpainted, a completely different canvas, which is then sold. We'll go into the reasons why in a moment. Okay, so this layman has been turned into a saint, but it isn't the original picture. Here's another one. This is one of my favourites. The Queen's got about 60,000 works of art, and every year she exhibits a number of them at Buckingham Palace, and the public can go and see those. And Ruth and I went a few years ago, and this is one of the paintings. We'd never heard of this painting. I mean, I actually don't know much about art. Ruth, my wife, did, but even she didn't know about this painting. And it's lovely, isn't it? Really, really beautiful portrait. But when you X-ray it, there's that. Now let's turn it upside down. Now let's cut that out. An old man has changed into an old woman by being turned upside down. And you see, Rembrandt, of course, wasn't wildly popular in his early days, and he was terrible at managing money. So if he wanted a new, if a painting wouldn't sell and you wanted to do another painting, he might not be able to afford a new canvas, so you would find one that wouldn't sell and paint over it, which is probably what he did here. Now, of course, with these last two pictures, nobody has ever, of course, taken the top off to show what's underneath, because what's on top is worth a serious sum of money. I mean, Rubens, you know? Rembrandt. Well, there is one painting I know of where that has been done. Now, there's no colour picture of this available, I'm afraid. But this was known to be a Dutch painting of some sort of 1637. And this is a Russian count. And his hat was actually quite a bright red. And most of his coat was green. We know that. Okay. And very early on, people realised that actually there was a lot going on underneath. And this had been painted over somebody else. And so they started messing about with some sort of terps or whatever they use to clear it up, and they decided they better stop because they're beginning to take away the underpaint as well. So they stopped at this point in 1950. You see the hat's gone. Okay, most of the rest is still there, it went around a couple of other French collectors, and the second one of those decided that he would see if somebody could sort it out. So, because it was a Dutch painting, he sent it to one of the world's foremost experts on restoration. His name is Martin Beale, who worked at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and is now in private practice. And he and a colleague of his thought the first thing they would do is they would X-ray it, and it's quite difficult to see, but there it says Rembrandt 1634, and it looked just like a typical Rembrandt signature, which actually is what Martin Beale had suspected might be the case. So they then gave it to Martin Beale to see what he could do with it. Now, of course, he couldn't use the chemical bit anymore because it was too dangerous. So he used another technique, which consists of getting hold of a surgical scalpel, putting a blade on it, and flicking off individual flakes of paint. That took him 2 years and several hundred scalpel blades. But he guessed what he was going to see underneath it, and he was right. Because he got to the point where he finished, and then he realised the two eyes were still different colours. So he got his scalpel out once more and did one more flick. That is Rembrandt. That's the first Rembrandt to come up for auction for 35 years. And, you know, like a lot of the other... he did a lot of self-portraits, Rembrandt, but this hadn't sold. So he gave it to one of his team to see if they could do a completely different painting over it. And in those days, Russian counts, would you believe, were all the rage. Everybody wanted to buy them, so it sold quite well. Not as well as that sold in auction in 2003. That was bought for virtually £8 million by an avid art collector. £8 million. The original was priceless, effectively. Now, the guy could afford it. He's worth £4 billion. And the reason why he's worth $4 billion is he owns most of the casinos in Las Vegas, and his name is Steve Wynn. And the irony is that this shaded eyes, was an amazing sort of conception that was in it. This shaded eyes was bought by a man who at that time was beginning to lose his eyesight from a progressive eye disorder. So that's another way in which a painting can be very different from how it started off. I thought what's happened here, this is the problem with using a PowerPoint, I think, on a... non-window projector. Okay, so masterpieces can be spoilt by being damaged, like the top one, by being faded, I don't know how this is going to look, or by being overpainted. Yeah? And to a greater or lesser extent, the same is true of most of us. Wonderful, supreme masterpieces painted by the supreme artist, our commander-in-chief. Unique, immensely valuable, and can become like this. And how does that happen? Well, let's go back to the damage. Now, there's going to be the actual damage, deliberate damage of violence. Now, this violence can, as well as being obviously sexual abuse, which I don't really want to discuss. I don't think it's the right time to do that. But supposing you've had an alcoholic father, or your mum married again a stepfather who was actually equally violent. Gives a wound in the soul, doesn't it? Very often. In the heart. Pew. But it can also happen unintentionally by parents, accidental damage by verbal comments, like, We really wanted a girl. You were a mistake. Why can't you ever be like your brother? You always disappoint us. Phrases like this go deep into the heart, and some of you know what I'm talking about. Now again, the faded ones. Every baby when it's born needs to be able to bond with its mother, which is where its true sense of being, I mean, Francis, you've been talking about Francis Minnott today, where their true sense of being is formed. But supposing the mother is incapable of mothering, like my mother, or supposing the mother has postnatal depression, or supposing the baby is premature and has been stuck in an incubator for a period of time, that bonding can be seriously flawed and may even be absent. And people like that can walk around feeling empty, as if there was they will even talk about there being a whole hill. Very often they put their hands there. I'm not talking about us before we're Christians. I'm talking about Christians who have not been led into any understanding of this sort of thing. The reason why this is so important is because the rest of the stuff that's been done this weekend may not really sort of quite sort of connect, because it doesn't. You tried it before and it doesn't work, and all the things you want to be, it doesn't sort of happen, and you get shame and guilt and all those sort of things when you actually, your hearts really want to follow Jesus, but there's something stopping us. This is just some of the stuff that does it. Anyway, another thing is lack of affirmation. This is of course also where the fathers come in as well. You know, sort of to encourage, to bless, to congratulate, to praise. Did your father do that for you? There's I was talking with a friend of mine, known her for years, and her father was very much like my mother, loved the kids, but was completely unable to convert in any emotional way whatsoever. So although the kids knew it up here, like I did, it didn't resonate at all. And in my case, it meant I was emotionally completely frozen, which led to some interesting effects when I got married to a lovely feminine woman, and when I was a father, when I had young children. That's another story. And this particular woman said that for the whole of her life, she never remembered her father saying that he loved her, even though she knew on one level that he did. And on a wedding day, the one thing she really wanted to hear her father say to her was, "Wow, you look beautiful." But he never did. Now, I have to say, we have watched that woman be transformed by Christ over the years. Over the years, you know, the 22 months of Eric Harding, the 2 years of Martin Beale and so on. And some people, for whatever reason, don't actually like themselves, so they become somebody else, which they think will be more acceptable, more attractive, more interesting. That's why Robin Williams became a comic. He'll say so himself. I've got quotes from a number of actors who don't know who they are, so they act somebody else. And it's possible for us to do this. It is possible for us to become successful. Some people it's sport, some people it's money, some people it's work, some people it's the armed forces, I expect. It gives an identity which makes a person feel better than they actually really do underneath. That is possible. And again, false identity. Now, my name's Dr. Miller, but a doctor is not who I am, it's what I do. I'm retired, I do very little medicine now, my identity is getting better all the time. Is your rank part of your identity? Particularly when everybody looks up to you or has to look up to you and salute you and so on. Nobody ever salutes doctors, of course. Is that actually what really makes you tick? And when that doesn't happen, is that what makes you feel awful about yourself? I don't know any of you. But if you're human beings like us civvies, I guess for some people there's something worth thinking about there. And the evidence after this is, we can actually, deep down, actually see ourselves like that. Or like that. Or like that. That is one of the reasons why we find it difficult to love other people. Because Jesus told us, and Paul repeated it from Leviticus, you shall love your neighbour as yourself. tricky to love your neighbour if you don't love yourself. Some people are aware of this, one of these things all the time, or in my case more than one of them. For example, in the business about sort of worldly success, I got a medical scholarship to Oxford, I got one doctorate, and I then got another doctorate, which is more than most people in the country have ever done. And I was still, as a Christian, having a deep, deep sense of inferiority. Nobody knew. Well, I'm sure my wife knew. Nobody knew. And I guess there's people in the services who maybe have risen to quite a high rank. And everybody thinks, great, you know, they're really good and everything else. And I was good at my job. But inside, they don't feel like that. That's possible, I guess. Certainly true where I'm coming from. But some people are not actually aware of this, but they become aware of it when they've had a really bad day, when something's gone wrong, when they're very tired, when they're awake in the middle of the night and can't go back to sleep, and this stuff pops up. And I'm sure it pops up at other times as well. Perhaps it pops up when you say all these other wonderful Christians rejoicing and being fantastic followers of Jesus, and you don't quite feel that's your shape at all. That's possible. I think it's very common, actually, but I want to give you some extremely good news, and that is that is not how God sees us. Now, of course, God is aware of all that. Of course he is. But God looks much deeper than that. God goes further back to that, and that, and that. And that is actually how God sees us, and how he wants to see ourselves. That, however much you're used to it, is a lie. It's surface. It's not the real truth. The real truth is the depths of God's creative beauty and power and imagination and uniqueness. This sort of move sideways. Anglicans here will recognise this is Justin Welby. And you may see from the background that this is actually in Coventry Cathedral, because between 2002 and 2007, he was working in the International Centre for Reconciliation, which is at Coventry Cathedral, for a reason which will become apparent in a minute. So this is the cathedral at Coventry, St Michael's Coventry, which you won't recognise because particularly on the 14th and 15th of November 1940, although it's over a long period of time, Coventry was bombed. Incidentally, only about sort of one and a quarter thousand people got killed in all those raids altogether. But there was a particularly intense bombing raid that night, and that was done to it. That picture was taken, I think, almost the next day. And after the war, they decided they were going to do something about this. So what they did was they cleared the rubble, and they asked 200 people, architects, to send designs, and they chose the one by Basil Spence, you may remember, with the lovely stained glass windows of Graham Sutherland, and built that, having cleared the rubble, leaving that as a memorial in the background. Completely different from the original. It was actually quite controversial. Most of it was paid for by the government. Now, Coventry is twinned both as a city and as a cathedral with Dresden. And that is the Lutheran Cathedral at Dresden, the Frauenkirche. Beautiful, isn't it? And over three nights, as you know, in February 1945, the very Lancaster bombers that I was building out of my airfix kit, hundreds of them, were dropping, I think, 3,000 tonnes, if I remember rightly, of bombs on Dresden. The actual number of people killed, the correct figure, which the Dresden authorities now give, is 25,000, so less than people used to say. That is still 20 times the number of people who were killed in Coventry over a much longer period of time. And the last day, the firestorm was so severe, this building exploded. That actually is a damaged statue of Martin Luther. And when the surviving people of Dresden woke up the next morning and saw this, they made a vow. It's one of the most bizarre and extraordinary vows I've ever heard anybody make. They vowed that after the war, they were going to completely rebuild this back to that. Now, of course, at the end of the war, this was now in East Germany. And the East German authorities would not let anybody touch any of that. They left the rubble there, they left everything there, because they wanted there to be a permanent historic reminder of what they saw as the dreadful decision the Allies made to bomb that. I dare say that those in the Air Force have had various discussions over the years about the ethics of that, and we don't need to go into that. But they, anyway, decided that couldn't be touched. So the citizens dressed and waited. And they waited. And they died. And they waited 45 years until the reunification of Germany. And then they set to work. No government funding this time. There is it now. It took 12 years to complete, which is twice as long as Coventry. At today's prices, it cost £200 million. 8 times the equivalent today's cost of the building of the new Coventry Cathedral. Now, if you look carefully, one or two places, there's some discolorations here and here. There's almost 4,000 of those in the whole building. And every single one of those is a brick from the original building, which was in the rubble, and they worked out where every single one of those bricks belonged. That's why it took so long. That looks like a shadow. It is actually the side view of what I showed you before, and here, you can see it's dark there, and that is the dark facade, north facade of the building. Moreover, have a look at the doors. Glorious, aren't they? Beautifully ornate. The difficulty was that nobody had any plans or drawings of the original doors, but they were determined that they were going to find out somehow. And what they did was, they asked all the surviving citizens of Dresden who'd been married in that cathedral to send in their wedding photographs, because they got photographed in front of the door. And some people sent whole wedding albums. That's how they did that. Now, I need to tell you this right now. When it comes to destroying, to repairing and repairing and damaged masterpieces, God is not a carpentry God. He doesn't say, oh, that's too bad, that's too damaged. Let's start again and do something different. God is a Dresden God. And if it takes 12 years, if it needs a Martin Beale to help, if it needs an Eric Harding, if it's going to be very costly in some way or other, that's what God does. And we know that because the prophets recognise that. And quite a few prophets mention this. And when a lot of the prophets wrote, Jerusalem hadn't yet been destroyed, but a lot of the other cities of Judah and previous of Israel had been destroyed by the Egyptians, by the Assyrians, and then by the Babylonians, and eventually, of course, Jerusalem itself. Arabic, you see. So we're talking about ancient ruins, age-old foundations, long devastated. Yeah. And now look at the words that Isaiah picks out. Rebuild, restore, renew, and repair. I'll come back to the word renew in a minute, but it's that's what Nehemiah did. He rebuilt the city wall, the gates, did it very quickly. They would have done the same with the temple if they'd had the money, but of course there was no money to rebuild Solomon's temple, so they couldn't do that. But they rebuilt the walls as they originally were, because they realised the heart of God. Just like Dresden people did. Non-Christians created in God's image somehow knew that was the way to handle such devastation. Now this is one of Isaiah's quotes that I just love. Okay, now that's each one of us, isn't it? I mean, otherwise, let's face it, we wouldn't be here. So what does he tell us to do? Never does any harm to go back to your roots. So what were their roots? Well, obviously, it's going to be Moses and the Exodus, isn't it? Apparently not. Abraham and Sarah, yeah? No, that's just a stopping off point. This is the quarry from which you were hewn. I thought you'd like to see an up-to-date photograph, colour photograph of the Garden of Eden. Now, about sort of 4 hours ago, the Commons voted by an overwhelming majority to send in bombing missions to Iraq again. And they're going to fly over where the Garden of Eden was in northern Iraq, but they won't find it, because it's actually here. This is Hawaii. This is actually an arboretum, and they've called it the Garden of the Lord, just out of interest. But you will remember the Garden of Eden. This is what is said in Genesis 2. The wonderful, beautiful creation, men and women in God's image. He planted a garden in Eden. Now, I guess most of you were either commissioned at Sandhurst or Cranwell or Dartmouth. Every one of those three places is not an accidental name. It all actually means something. I don't know if you know what Cranwell means, or even the... But anyway, I can tell you later if you like. But they've all got a meaning, just like Oxford's got a meaning. It's the Ford of Oxen, where they used to trade, where I come from. Eden is the Hebrew word for delight. I like that. God puts us in the garden of life. It talks about the trees, lots of different types, wonderful to eat and so on. I mean, it's a glorious picture in Genesis 2 of the Garden of Eden. Now, the New Testament writers, although of course they had access to the Hebrew scriptures, they didn't tend to use them, particularly Matthew and Paul. What they did was they used the Greek translation of the scriptures, which you may know is called the Septuagint, and it was generated by around about 70 Jewish scholars in Alexandria because, of course, of the increasing Hellenization of the that part of the centre of the world, which the Romans sort of carried on with. So if they had looked at this phrase, Garden in Eden, this is what they would have seen in Greek. Now, I don't expect you to be sort of particularly fluent in Greek, but you can put it, oh, actually, I had it in Greek letters, actually. This, as I said, this is the problem with not having a Windows computer. I had it in Greek letters. There you are. Paradison en Edem. Paradise in Eden. Now, paradise is a very old Persian word, and it actually means a large estate with a wall around it. I mean, Blenheim Palace is in the middle of an estate called Blenheim, where I live, and I think there's one or two around where you live, Hempton Empter. It's probably the nearest one to Portsmouth, but anyway. It is the phrase that would have been used about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar, a paradise. So this is a parkland of delight, as David Pawson used to call it. Now, of course, you're all thinking now, ah, but hang on, Jesus said to the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise, did he not? And going back to the Ephesians, I was going to use one of the Paul's prayers to the Ephesians, but I've got to because we had another prayer. But that's fine. And when God spoke to the seven churches in Turkey through John, he gave each one of them a separate promise if they persisted to the end, to those who overcome. And in the case of the Ephesians, Ephesus, God says through John, to those who overcome, I will grant the right to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. Of course, the tree of life, there it is again, Genesis 2. And of course, it comes at the end of Genesis in the New Jerusalem. So the paradise of delight, the Garden of Eden, isn't just where we come from. It's where we're going. I would like to suggest to you, it is where we can begin to start living now. Not completely, but increasingly, to explore, to discover, to be creative in, to wonder at, to be fed at. That's what we did in the old days. That's what we're going to do in the future. That's what my wife's doing now. Wonderful, isn't it? Now, I first came to realise this about, I don't know, 15 years ago. I mean, I've been a Christian since I was 12, so it's quite a long time. And I've been to a healing conference. In fact, it happened to be a Dan Payne conference. And on that particular day, they'd done prayer for people with mother deprivation, which, believe me, was certainly true of me. And, you know, that God really touched me very deeply with that. Anyway, I went back to my room that evening, and I was mulling over what had happened that day. And for some reason, I found myself in this passage here. And I dare say, I mean, certainly in the old days, this is something we were very familiar with. And, of course, it comes again in Ephesians. You know, put off your old self and put on a new self. And, of course, the old self is pretty obvious. The old self is our fallen self, our Genesis 3 self, the spoiled self, the self that leads to those pictures at the top. And then it says, we have put on the new. Now, what is this new self? Now, Paul himself says, and this is what most preachers will tell you, is the new self is our identity with Christ. We're baptised with him in his death. We're raised by him to new life. We're filled with the Spirit. We're children of God. All of which is absolutely true and absolutely wonderful. And that's what Paul says, but not here. What here he says, something completely different. Three times he says it. Those of you who are familiar with Paul know that he tends to sort of repeat himself. We'll come back to that word again. Renewed. Image, creator. The phrase the image of God comes about 7 or 8 times in the Bible, as I remember. Every single time it goes back to Genesis 1. And of course, we've got the creator there. Yeah? And that is where we saw before. Now, in both Hebrew and in Greek, there's two words for new. The one that we'd be familiar with is the one where you get a sort of a new smartphone. Yeah. Apple 6 or whatever it's called for. Whatever. I'm waiting for the next iPad. Or maybe it's probably a bit too old for something, or a new girlfriend or whatever. That's sort of new. But the other word doesn't mean that. The other word means something that's been there before and is being renewed every day. You remember that bit in Lamentations about the mercies of God are new every morning. These are not new, different mercies. It's the same mercies being refreshing us daily, feeding us, restoring us, renewing us, encouraging us, building us. It's those sort of mercies. Like dew. It's said like dew. The dew, it says, is renewed because, of course, every morning it comes down and refreshes the ground. I've seen that the last few weeks in my little garden. And I've got a library ticket. And if I go to our local library and take a book out, it might be a big book and I might be busy and I might not have much time to read it, and the 3 weeks is up. So obviously what I do is take this book back and change it for another one. Except that I have the facility to renew it, which means I can keep the book another 3 weeks, and in our library I can do that for quite a long time. And then, over a period of time, I can begin to get the full experience and joy and depth and meaning and conclusion of that book, which I would have completely lost if I hadn't renewed it. Renewed, that is our new self. So actually, our new self is our original old self. And I think a lot of believers don't actually understand that who they really are in Christ is actually the original self, being recreated and restored and repaired in his beautiful, glorious image. I think it actually makes quite a difference to the way you actually see what's happening in your own lives now. And in case you, even this, you think slightly not sure about the theology of this, I noticed this in, we had an infant baptism service in our church a few months ago, and I spotted this for the child: may Almighty God restore in you in the image of his glory. Not a bad prayer for us to pray for ourselves if we feel it's appropriate and necessary. So, how do we go from A to B, as it were? Well, the answer is quite simply that God loves doing that work. I mean, do you think Eric Harden just said, oh God, not another bloody awful job to do, this is going to take years and years, I'll get on with it, at least they'll pay me? Is that what Eric Harden and Martin Beale thought? Is that what the system doesn't thought as they were doing this 12 years of extraordinarily expensive work? They're doing it because they really, really wanted to, and they loved the idea, and they really knew what they were looking for, and they could imagine what the future, what it was going to be like, and they said, yes, I'm going to go for this. And God basically gives us an invitation. The invitation is this: to allow us, to allow him to renew us and to cooperate with that restoring process. That means repenting of the false way we see ourselves. I mean, the reality is, let's face it, as I think we really know, that a lot of growth requires repentance at some point. And asking God to do that, and to gradually, what will happen is that over a period of time, that will happen. This comes with a health warning. Number one, in my experience, it takes a long time. I guess it's still going on, although the great majority God's done over the years that I know needed doing. The second thing is that it's possible that God is wanting to do is to stick you under the X-ray machine, and then you'll see something there that you had no idea existed. You don't recognise it. It's a stranger to you, and you feel frightened by it, even though it's the truth of how we see ourselves. Because God deals with truth, and of course, with mercy and compassion, doesn't he? That's what makes it work. We all know that. Second health warning is, over the years, our varnish may have got very coated, and it can become a protection. It protects us from further wounds or insults or damage or pain, emotional stuff like that. But it's making us look the wrong colour. It's making us insipid, boring, unwatchable, not worth anything. But when you actually start using chemicals to take surface off, the underlying surface can get pretty raw, and it can feel very raw and painful. Particularly if God decides sometimes he's going to get his scalpel out and flick the paint off. Many of you here, and I certainly, will say, believe me, it's worth it. It is so worth it. So, and what do you notice happens? I'll come back to that in a minute. The first thing that happens is that we'll begin to see ourselves differently, and we will begin to see each other in this room and in our churches differently. And beyond that, I'm a street pastor. You talked about Sue Skippage. She's actually the equivalent of a street pastor in Aldershot, which is how I know about all the unemployed ex-soldiers, some with mental health problems. She was telling me about those. And I go in the streets at night and you see these girls who you wonder how they dress like they do, and they're vomiting and they're quite rude and so on. But if you cannot see beyond that to the real person, and when you get to chatting to them, it becomes easier and easier to find the real person underneath. I couldn't do it. But I'm learning to see other people in spite of all the way they come across, all the greyness, the muckiness, and all the violence, and all the sort of false sort of images that they project. I don't know if you know that the Greek word for an actor is the same word we call hypocrite. Hippocrates. Not high Hippocrates is the word for actor. And of course in the Greek plays, they actually used to, if they wanted to show what somebody was like, they didn't dress up, they put a mask on. Do you remember? The mask. Those masks were Hippocrates. Hypocrites. And there's so many people walking around who actually present something that's completely different from who they really are. And when you actually get the opportunity to sort of chat to them and let them open up, it's much easier to see them as God sees them. That's the first thing that happens. The second thing that happens is that Jesus can sit across you, like here, or next to you, like here, and you can look in his eyes, and you don't need to turn away. You don't need to feel ashamed. You don't need to feel unworthy. And what's more, you can recognise his smile and his kindness, and can smile back. Take me a long time to get to that point. A few years ago, at one of these conferences, it was like Jesus in the garden outside. A few years later, it was Jesus was in a room at the far side. Now, Jesus sits next to me, opposite me. In fact, actually, once a week on average, I actually cook him a meal and lay a place for him and talk to him, turn everything else off and talk to Jesus, as it were. I don't need him to have my wine, mind you, but I talk with him. That, I mean, the phrase intimacy with God was something that actually used to make me feel creepy. Not anymore, because God has graciously done all this, or so much of this, to bring this into place. Now, another thing that happened is going to The Hobbit. Now, talking about library cards, when I was 17, which was 50 years ago, my sister had read this book. This is before we'd read Lord of the Rings, and this is the original cover of those days of the book we got at the library, The Hobbit. And very early on in the book, we have the dwarves moaning at Gandalf for bringing this hobbit along. I mean, let's face it, they saw themselves as the special forces. You know, Smaug and the shooting the arrow, Dale and the dragon, that sort of stuff. And they couldn't understand what this dumpy little civilian, who was small, who was podgy, who'd never been on an adventure anywhere in his life, who stammered, what on earth was he coming along for? Well, the reality is that Gandalf saw deeper than that. Maybe one or two people here need to take them on board. I don't know. By the end of the book, we realise just how right Gandalf was. And that is not mainly anything to do with the magic ring he picked up on the way. It's all the other stuff. Those of you who read the book know what I mean. If you haven't read it, please do. Tolkien, of course, is a Christian, as you know. He was the person who C.S. Lewis got converted. Anyway, seeing as how this is a forces thing, I thought you'd like to see this this picture. This is an oil painting, obviously a portrait. And I don't know if you like to guess how much. I won't go give one of these guessing games. But anyway, it is now in the National Portrait Gallery, who bought it in 2002 for £2,680,000. I mean, blimey, you could Photoshop a picture for about 5p, couldn't you? That sold for that much money. Why? Well, it's pretty good. Why is it pretty good? He and Joshua Reynolds were the foremost portrait painters of the age. So there's one of his pictures of an army officer. I thought you'd like to see one of his pictures of a naval officer. And the those in the Navy hopefully will know all about Admiral Vernon. He wore these coats. These coats were made of a mixed fabric. And this is a complete red herring. I just throw it in for interest. And this particular fabric in those days was called Grogham. And as a result of that, the nickname he picked up in the Navy was Old Grog. You may think that's wrong, but it isn't. Because Vernon did something else, which has lasted in the Navy, I think, till, was it 1970 it was stopped? What he did was, he took their usual tot of rum, and he added to it either lemon juice or lime juice, because otherwise the taste was quite unpleasant. And he found that if you put a citrus additive into it, it made all the difference. That is what grog is in the Navy. Grog was invented by Old Grog from the coat for the rum that he mixed up with. And that is the reason why, in his time, his were the very few ships that had very little trouble with scurvy. Of course, nobody knew why until 30 years later. Okay, so that's Sir Vernon. He got dismissed from the Navy, by the way, I believe. But, I mean, some of you will know all about that. Now, I've been hunting for another portrait of Gainsborough with an Air Force officer, but for some reason I've been unable to track one down. Sorry, folks. Apologise to you fly boys and fly girls. Now, what I've done here is, Gainsborough did loads of these. What I've done is I've taken a whole load of men that he painted and just taken the face bit out, just a sort of little montage. Yeah? And this is a similar one he did with women, just a collection of these I've sort of found in different places. And when you look at these, there's a number of things about them which are true of us. First is, they've all been painted by an absolute master. Secondly, they're all worth a great deal of money. Thirdly, they're all beautiful. And fourthly, they're all completely different from each other, of course. That's the beauty, of course, of God's painting, isn't it? And as we get, this is what, as we've got to know each other, there's even, I've got to know some people here already, just briefly. It's just lovely how different we are, and yet we're, you know, God's working in our lives, commander in chief, is that it? So on. Now the problem with this, is if I wanted to see all these pictures in one place, I couldn't, you see, because they're all spread around the country, these pictures. And so if I wanted to see a collection, a large number of glorious masterpieces, unique, enormously valuable, what I could do is I could, I think you still have travel warrants or whatever you do, but anyway, I could actually take a trip to London and I could go back to our friend Trafalgar Square, to here, which is actually next door, this entire, it's next door to the National Gallery. And you remember I said that's where one of those pictures was. Yep. To one of that Colonel Bullock. So I could go in there. They've got tens of thousands of amazing portraits in there, only a few of which, probably about 9,000-10,000 on display at any one time, perhaps less than that. So I could go into there and I could walk along there and I can get to the door and I could do what this woman is doing or this man who is seated is doing. I could do all that. And I could really spend time sitting there and enjoying and marvelling and getting real value out of that. I could do that. I don't need to do that. That's an unnecessary journey. Because if I want to see some really fabulous masterpieces by the fantastic artist and the superb restorer, all I need to do is come in here and look at you. And you. And you. And you. And you. I've been wondering how to pray this in. Do you think I should go for what we talked about or not?
Yes, I think you should.
Okay, right. Of course, you don't know me. You never met me before. I'll be leaving later on this evening. so you may not be willing to take up this suggestion, but I would like to make a suggestion about how it's possible to respond to anything God may have been saying. Some of you won't need to. Some of you would rather spend a bit of time this evening or the rest of this weekend chatting to people, whatever, or back on your own, mulling it over and thinking about it. Okay? But some of you, I hope, are willing to respond to God's invitation. And as I say, this requires two things. It requires courage and it requires persistence. One of the things about the armed forces is you don't stand the armed forces if you haven't got courage and persistence, both as a serving officer and if you're the wife of a serving officer, you know, the sacrifices you make in sort of where you live and all those other things, I guess that needs a fair bit of courage and determination as well. So this is a group of people with determination and courage. Now, if you feel you wish to respond to that, what I'm going to suggest that we do in a minute is those who want to, you just stand up. I think we can do it where you are, actually. Yeah, probably. Let's just stand up where you are. And then I or perhaps Mark as well. Actually, we'll come to you. We won't pray with you. We'll just... if you just close your eyes, I haven't got glass, have you? No, okay. Well, got glass, you can take them off. Close your eyes, and all we do, we will anoint you with oil in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Remember, when Jesus sent his disciples out, it says in Mark, he told them to anoint the sick. Most people forget that. Yeah. So this is Jesus stuff that we're talking about. And the reason for doing that is quite apart from actually making a commitment, not necessarily in front of everybody else, but standing up for yourself, is that when you anoint with oil, it is not a sign of God's healing. More than that, it's an agent of God's healing. There's some mystery in that, like communion, there's a mystery in that. Okay? So in a sense, God will, in a sense, start, or whatever speed, or whatever way, doing what you're signing up for, as it were. That's the suggestion. So if... is that okay? Okay, but so as I say, I know you don't know me, and you know this may sound maybe some of you this is a slightly strange idea, but anyway, if you feel that's what you're up for, and as I say, some of you won't need it, and others you are not ready for it. If you feel that's what you're up to, I suggest you stand up now.